We're doing the Sefer Amidot by the Magid Miduvna. We're up to the 8th chapter in the Shar HaGava. We're discussing arrogance. And the Magid Miduvna had said that when a person reads about the giants of Jewish history and their dedication in the service of Hashem, that helps a person recognize how faulty he is. And that will help a person cut himself down to size. Then Magid Miduvna had said, I'll give you an allegory about a king who has a son who isn't too intelligent, and he takes the son who isn't too bright and he gives him a little kingdom to rule over, and he ensures that the servants and the people in that city are dumber than his own son, and this way his son could run the show there. One day his advisors come in, and they see the king sitting with his son explaining to him what it's like to run the whole kingdom. So they get nervous. They say, does he really think this kid is going to run the whole kingdom? And after the kid leaves, they ask him, what are you doing? So the king says, look, the kid has been growing up in a little town that I set up for him. He runs the town. Everyone there is half retarded, and so he thinks he's a genius. He doesn't realize there's a bigger world out there. He thinks just like he's smarter than everyone in town, so too he's smarter than everyone in the world. So I'm sitting here discussing with him what it's like to run the kingdom so that he understands there's a bigger world out there and he has an appreciation what his role is in this bigger world. Because if I let him just stay in his little bubble, he'll think he's a genius. He won't realize his limitations. So too, Hanimshal, we're on page Shin Yud Zayin. What's this an allegory for? Nishmat Adam Batzmuta Halobat Melechi. When we look at the human soul, in essence, she's a princess. Atzulam nishmat shakai. The soul is really gleaned from the spirit of God, so to speak. God breathed life into us. Bilti al yedei tchabutai maguf kegufot habalei chaim. So life, our neshama, is something spiritual. When it says God breathed life into man, it doesn't mean that God did CPR, mouth to mouth. Oh, now man is alive. No. It means that God breathed a part of himself into man. In other words, God put spirituality into man. That is the neshama. That is the life that keeps our bodies ticking. Bilti al yedei tchabutai maguf ki gufot habalei chaim. Technically, the soul has a life of its own. The soul doesn't need the body needs the soul. After a person dies, the soul continues. It's the body that can't live without the soul. The only thing is, you recognize the soul through a different picture. Because the king, blessed be he, said to the soul, go down. And so the soul went down a level, really, to descend into a human body. And now the soul is hidden in the thickness of this corporal, physical, mundane body. So now the soul is limited. It's confined to this little body with its desires, its foibles. And so God assigned the soul a little city, a little town, just like the king gives his retarded son, so too God gave the body, the soul in the body, a little city. Hu olam hazeh, that's this world that we live in. That's the little city within which we live. And so God created within this world all kinds of servants that are retarded compared to man. You look around, you look at all the other creatures, you say, I'm so much smarter than the bear and the lion and the dog. I remember I once came out of shul and I had my son with me, and a dog came sniffing at us. This big dog, he reached me like above the waist, and I didn't know if this dog was going to bite or not. I don't know this dog. So I distracted the dog and I told my son, go home. And then I got nervous because I wasn't sure if he's going to take a bite out of my calf or something. So I started to run. And the dog, I don't know if it was interested in biting me or thought it was a game, but once I started to run, it ran after me. So I sent my son the short route home. and I took the long route with the dog on my tail. And I figured to myself, what am I going to do to this dog? So in the back of the house we were living in at the time, there was a patio that had a very smooth, it had like tiles, but very, very smooth tiles. And it had been raining, and I was running with rubber soles. I said to myself, I'm going to run fast and turn the corner on those tiles. The dog on its nails won't be able to turn the corner. It's going to go flying on the tiles, and then I'll be able to turn into the house, and it's going to go. And that's exactly what happened. I rounded the bend, and the dog goes flying into the bushes, and it gives me just enough time for me to run into the house and close the door behind me, and that's the end of the story. And I remember as I was doing it, I was marveling. I was thinking, isn't it beautiful to have intelligence? Isn't it so, like, great? You know, I'm thinking that I'm looking at the dog, and he's, like, huffing at my heels, and I'm thinking, thank God I'm not a dog. Okay, you know, I was granted the intelligence that I could actually do something, that he'll go flying and I'll make it home, even though he's got bigger teeth than me, and he's got, you know, he runs quicker than me. So the Magen Mituvna says, yeah, if you're comparing yourself to a dog, boy, are you smart. So God put us in this planet where we have all these retarded creatures compared to us, and now we feel smart. Now, I remember asking myself as I walked into the house, asking myself, am I supposed to be proud or not? You know, so I outsmarted a dog. Okay, is that good or is that bad? You know, I couldn't help but be happy. I had figured out a way to throw him off. But, you know, so the Magen Mituvna says, we're that retarded child. So God put the soul in this world and gave the soul people or creatures who were less intelligent than the soul, than the human. In other words, the animals, the birds, the fish. Now God created them in a way that you can train them and you could tame them and they're going to listen to you. You can take control of the domim, the inanimate objects, the tzomeach, that's the plants, the things that grow, and the chai, the living creatures. So man was put in the planet, and now he feels like he's a great knocker. Look at me. I take control of all these things. Being that man only looks at what's before him, the things that walk opposite him, that's why man could be proud. Because man compares himself to what he sees around him. Man can start thinking and be arrogant about the strengths he has, the accomplishments he has, the traits that he's perfected. And then man could start thinking how precious he is. But when a Jew starts reading something bigger, the way to serve his Creator, he starts reading about the perfection and the fashion of service that's going up in heaven, the secrets of what's really happening in the world, and he starts reading about the service of the prophets, the righteous, the pious, they dedicated everything they had in their service of Hashem. And he starts reading about how holy they were, how pure they were, how separate they were. They were able to keep themselves separate from being drawn by the mundane. There's a famous story. I'll tell you a story from now. The Rebbe of Chabad. I don't remember if it was Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av that the Shamish noticed it was midnight and he was still talking to Hasidim, because people kept coming to him and asking him questions and he wouldn't turn anyone away and he hadn't yet broken his fast. At about midnight, the Shamish came in and said, Rebbe, you have to eat something. I don't remember if it was after Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur, a 24-hour fast, one or the other. Can we imagine such a thing? People are asking a person questions and he's after a 24-hour fast, he's not a young man, and he doesn't say a word. He keeps answering and helping and assisting and being there for people. You know the story of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was in a ride in the car, and after the car pulled away off the curb, about 10 seconds later, when they turned the bend, he asked the driver to pause a second, opens the door and pulls his hand in. The guy standing outside had closed the door on his hand, and he didn't want to say anything, not to embarrass him. So he's standing there with his hand in the door, but he doesn't want to say anything until the car's rounded the bend. So you read these stories, and you say, that's someone who I lived around the block from him. You know, it's not someone you read about in a storybook. This is someone who I grew up in the community where he was a rabbi in Muncie, New York. So you start reading about these giants, and you say, oh, so there's something greater than me out there. Anyway, we go through life initially thinking, look how great I am, look at my accomplishments. And then you start reading about what giant people did, and it gives us perspective. It helps a person with his arrogance. I once spoke to Rav Pesin Zatzal about brilliance and how humbling it is when you encounter brilliance. So he told me the following story. If you guys go down this block, down the block of Machon Meir, so you hit the light, and then you can continue straight down, right? And then the street forks to the left or right. Yes, you go straight down the block, you hit the end of Ha'ilui, and the street goes either left or right. If you take a left, and after the first house, you go down the driveway, there's this huge complex, a huge building that runs a whole block long, which was once upon a time an orphanage. An orphanage that was built by a rabbi named the Maharil Diskin. He lived here about 150 years ago. Now, he was such a genius that he could look at a tree and tell you how many leaves were on the tree. So his students looked at him and said, Rabbi, how do we know if you're telling the truth? He wants to go and pick all the leaves off the tree and count. And he said, I'll tell you how you could test me. I'll turn around, and you pick off the tree as many leaves as you want. And when I turn back, I'll tell you how many leaves are on the tree. So the students tested him, and he got it right. So that's genius. We had over here in Jerusalem a great sage that when women would bring him their cloths to check, this is a story now from this century. The Maharil Diskin was last century. So this century. So a woman, when she checks herself in the 7 days of purity, sometimes she has a color that she's uncertain what that color is. So the rabbis have a tradition going back millennium, which teaches us how to discern between different colors to be able to tell, does this color come from the womb or not? I mean, rabbis will sometimes tell a woman, I think you have cancer of the cervix, because they can tell from the... It's part of the tradition. At any rate, coming back to... there was a rabbi in Bnei Brak who was shown a cloth, and he said, it's pure. And the woman was a little bit nervous, and the students were also a little bit shocked that he could look at that color and discern that it was a pure color. So they decided they're sending the cloth back in a second time. They wanted to see what he'd say. So they send it in a second time, and he says, I saw this cloth already. Why are you asking me a second time? So someone asked him, how do you know? So he told them exactly how many threads were running both sides of the thread, both sides of the cloth. He said, I'll tell you, because that cloth had, I don't remember the number, this number of threads running this way and this number of threads running that way. So he passed away shortly thereafter, and the person who asked the question decided he's going to check. You know, there's always someone like that. So he sat down and took it apart, and he thought, the rabbi got it. So that's there's a phenomenal discerning eye. I'll tell you a story that I did. There's a rabbi who I study under who lives here in the neighborhood. And I once took a cloth that I had seen by him, and I wanted to study it, to learn that color. And as I was looking at it, it was just after I had fed the kids lunch, and I hadn't noticed there was a little bit of ketchup on my finger. So some of the ketchup went on the cloth. So now the cloth turned a little bit red. So I decided I wasn't so confident in his answer. So I took the cloth back to him the next week, and now it has a reddish tinge on it. And I didn't say a word. I just said, is this cloth, is it clean or not? What's the halacha? So he looks at it, and he says, clean. So I said, wait, isn't there something red over there? He says, that's dirt. That doesn't come from a human body. So I decided, okay, we'll try a second time. I took another cloth, a week or two later, and I had, you know, sometimes on your finger you have a little bit of bleeding, like a little bit of skin that at the edge of the nail that gets peeled off. So I had a drop of bleeding there, and I touched it to a cloth, and I brought the cloth to the rabbi. So I'm sitting on the side and I hand him the cloth and I'm waiting. And he's looking and he's looking and he's looking. And after about half a minute, I couldn't contain myself. I said, "Rabbi, what's so hard about that cloth? That was an obvious, you know, isn't there a drop of blood there?" So he says to me, "Do you know which woman gave you this cloth?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I think she has a little wound in her finger." I said, "Why do you think that?" He said, "Because that's a color that comes from a finger that doesn't come from the uterus. That's not a color that would come from her. So if you could find out, if the woman could check, if maybe she's wounded in her finger, that makes more sense to me. It's not a..." Okay, so at any rate, that's a story from this decade. Not so you start seeing genius and brilliance and tradition, and you see, okay, wow, wait a second. So there's more wisdom out there than I know. So that is humbling for a person. When a person suddenly sees, okay, there's more out there. If we don't encounter it, if we stay in our little bubble, just like the retarded son of the king, so then we could really get it convinced that we're geniuses. But when you come in contact with something bigger, then you say, okay. I used to say it's worth going to Rav Shlomo Fisher's shiur. You guys can go, but it's in Hebrew. I don't think you'll follow it. Rav Shlomo Fisher, I guess I should tell you the full story. Okay, if you won't hear it now, you probably never hear it. About 100 years ago, the British were in power here, and the Arabs decided to riot and make a pogrom in Mea Shearim. So they got together and they charged. They came in with their machetes, and there was one guy leading the band into Mea Shearim to wreak havoc, just as they had in Tzfat. It was about 100 years ago. And there was one man who had trained in the army. His name was Fisher, and he had a gun. And he saw the Arabs coming down the street, and he saw the guy who was leading them all on a horse, wielding his machete. And he pulled out his gun and he shot the leader and killed him. And when he shot the leader, all the Arabs turned around and ran away. And with that, he saved all of Mea Shearim. The British heard about it, and they wanted to know who killed the Arab. They wanted to at least imprison him and for sure punish him and possibly execute him. And from that day onward, Rabbi Fisher had to go underground. No one could know where he was. And he spent years underground in hiding from the British. And he really suffered a lot. He didn't have a normal family life. He didn't have a home. He spent his life as a fugitive. And one day, one of the rabbis of Mea Shearim met him and saw how hard he had it. And he blessed him. He said to him, "You should know, you saved all of the Jews of Mea Shearim. You will be blessed that your children will all be giants in Torah." And that's what happened. He had one son who was the head of the Eda Haredis, Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher. He was the chief justice of the Eda Haredis. He passed away about 7 years ago. And he had another son who's still alive, who's still with us at Me'ev Eshem today. He lives in Har Nof. His name is Rav Shlomo Fisher. Rav Shlomo Fisher, when he got married, part of the deal with his wife was that he only comes home Friday for Shabbos. All week long, he's a man who's in his 80s. From the time he got married in his 20s till today, he leaves on Matzei Shabbos or Sunday morning. He goes to yeshiva. He comes home on Thursday night or Friday morning. And that's the only time he's home. The rest of the time he's learning. So it's worth going to hear his class, because when he speaks, I once asked him a question. And he looked at me like, "That's so obvious." And he quoted me a far-out sefer, like sefer that most people never even reach in their life. And he looks like, "What are you asking me? You know, it's clearly written over there." To him, that's obvious. So that's it. Now, you have to understand, he's a genius. He'll quote you Freud with the same tip of the tongue, you know, and Søren Kierkegaard. And he studies like all knowledge. It's not only Talmud and Medrash and commentaries. So you see a person like that, you say, "Wow, okay, there's greatness out there." By the way, I didn't end the story of the Maharil Diskin. So when I spoke to Rav Pesen Zatzal about brilliance, so he said to me, "Yeah, there are stories like that story about the Maharil Diskin," and he told me that story about the Maharil Diskin and the trees and the leaves, and then he said, "Makes one feel like a worm." Okay. what was strange was that when I speak to Rav Pesin, Rav Pesin was a person who would read a page at a time. He couldn't read not a line at a time, not a word at a time. He'd read a page at a time. This is how he'd read a book. I know because one of the people who came to his class was a mathematician, and he wrote a book on mathematics, and he told me that he brought it to Rav Pesin. And Rav Pesin took the book and started leafing through it. And after about 10 pages, the guy says, Rebbe, aren't you going to read it? So he said, I did. So he said, no, don't you want to see what it says? So Rav Pesin gave him back the book and says, this is where I got up to, test me. So he asked him a question or two, and he saw he knew it. And he said about the Maril Diskin makes one feel like a worm. So what was I supposed to feel like standing next to him? At any rate, that's what the Magen Midvna says, that one of the ways to challenge our own arrogance is when we start realizing the greatness that's out there. When we read about, when we visit, when we see the giants. By the way, that's one of the benefits of going to funerals of big people. If you can understand what's being said about the person, you start having an appreciation of what a great person really is. The Talmud says in Horios that there were geniuses that could figure out how many drops of water are in the sea. You had sages who were able to reach such heights that they could explain the constellations, they could figure out the cycles of the different stars, they could figure out the locations of stars. And, you know, NASA, only about 25 years ago, reached an exact calculation of the cycle of the moon to two places or three places past the decimal point, which Chazal had. Chazal had figured out part of our calculations for figuring out the moon go to that point after the decimal point, which with all the satellites and everything, NASA was able to figure it out. So we're you start seeing the brilliance. You say, what's going on here? You know, there's a Zohar that discusses the earth spinning. There's a Sephorno that discusses the tilt on the axis and when it happened. You start seeing things. They say, okay, how'd they figure that out? לדרוש ולחקוב גובי מומים עד כנפי הקרובים, כמרם זל, הרבה ציפור לדרוש מרכביו להורות עמימיהם. The Talmud says, you had sages, you had many sages who were able to give fancy speeches about what's going on in the heavenly chariots, even though they never saw it. So, okay, that's a level of genius that we don't begin to understand. You read Nachmanides and his description of the atom and his description of the beginning of creation with the smallest form of matter. And you say, how'd he get there? And he tells you, oh, it's in the Torah, didn't you see? And you say, where? Where did you see that creation began with the smallest form of matter and then there's an evolvement? So that the Magen Midvna is in the middle of developing, that's part of the path that one can take to counter one's own arrogance, to look around and start seeing the greatness that's out there.